Okay, there's a lot of as with almost all these minor prophets, that there's a lot of contention over when they actually conducted the period of prophecy, when they wrote. Habakkuk is oblivious to the Assyrian Empire, doesn't mention Israel at all, that the northern 10 tribes, they're already deported, they're already off the scene or gone from the scene in Palestine. His warnings and his prophecy are all against the people of Jerusalem, the people of Judah that are left in Jerusalem. Assyria is already gone. He doesn't mention Nineveh or any of that history. It seems that Habakkuk wrote in the last days of Josiah, King Josiah, not any earlier than that, and more likely in the three kings who followed him, in the time of the kings who followed him, four kings, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah, is most likely when Habakkuk wrote. And the circumstances of the book demonstrate that as we commence with it. And that would make him a contemporary of the early portions of the ministries of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. The early to mid portions. He had Habakkuk had one other contemporary prophet, and that would be Zephaniah, who was prophesying around the same time. Daniel is very early in his life, and I'm not sure if he's actually prophesying yet. It seems that he starts around the time of Nebuchadnezzar, just a little later, after Josiah is passed, after Josiah is dead, is when Daniel begins his prophesying. So right here with Habakkuk, we have Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Habakkuk and Zephaniah all conducting their ministries in and around Jerusalem, where Daniel starts just a little later. So I would say we're sometime between 608 BC and 595, maybe a little later BC here. That's the best we could do with Habakkuk. That's all I have to say.
All right, Habakkuk 1:1. The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. O Yahweh, how long shall I cry, and thou wilt not hear? Even cry out unto thee of violence, and thou wilt not save. Why dost thou show me iniquity, and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention.
Microphone muted.
Therefore the law is slacked, and judgment doth never go forth. For the wicked doth compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceedeth. Behold ye among the heathen, and regard, and wonder marvellously. For I will work a work in your days, which ye will not believe, though it be told you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. They are terrible and dreadful. Their judgment and their dignity shall proceed of themselves. Their horses also are swifter than leopards, and are more fierce than the evening wolves. And their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They shall fly as the eagle that hasteth to eat. They shall come all for violence, their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn unto them. They shall deride every stronghold, for they shall heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. Art thou not from everlasting, O Yahweh, my God, mine Holy One? We shall not die, O Yahweh. Thou hast ordained them for judgment, and O mighty God, thou hast established them for correction. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look on iniquity. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest thy tongue when the wicked devoureth the man that is more righteous than he? And makest men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them? They take up all of them with the angle, they catch them with their net, and gather them in their drag. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. Therefore they sacrifice unto their net, and burn incense unto their drag, because by them their portion is fat, and their meat plenteous. Shall they therefore empty their net, and not spare continually to slay the nations?
So this has to be before 605 BC. If it's, I will raise up the Chaldeans, it seems to me that it's before 605 BC, because that's when Nebuchadnezzar began his military campaigns. And one of the first things Nebuchadnezzar had done was to go to Jerusalem and subject the people of Judah, subject them, because they had been subject to the Assyrians until 612 BC when Nineveh fell. Jerusalem was one of the first peoples that Nebuchadnezzar made subject to Babylon once again, probably in 605 BC. And shortly thereafter were Daniel and Ezekiel and the others taken into Babylon as hostages, the 1,000 princes of Judah around that time. This, so Ezekiel's prophecy, Habakkuk may have actually started before Ezekiel, because Ezekiel's prophesying started while he was in captivity. And he wasn't in captivity until the time of Nebuchadnezzar. But Jeremiah's prophesying had already started. So it seems to me that I would have to date the beginning of Habakkuk to the very last years of Josiah. That's my opinion. It's difficult to prove definitively, but it's shown in the circumstances here, in my opinion. So I will raise up the Chaldeans means that they're coming, but they haven't been here yet. So it's got to be before 605 BC, and in the waning years of Josiah. That's my opinion. Can't prove that exactly, but that's the best hypothesis I have on when Habakkuk had written. The Chaldeans are called a bitter and hasty nation here, and I don't really know what the historical basis for that is. I really don't, but the Chaldeans have been at war in Mesopotamia for a long, long time, right? They were at war with the Persians, and they were subject to the Persians at times. They were subject to Canaanite tribes at various times, that they had only been able to free themselves from the Assyrians with the help of all the other subject nations. And they had at one time, they had a great empire in Mesopotamia early on, and they hadn't had one for a long time until the second Babylonian or Neo-Babylonian empire of Nebuchadnezzar. And then it was really short-lived. It only lasted about 70 years, 75 years. That was it. Most of that was the time that Nebuchadnezzar himself ruled, and after he ruled,
user entered your channel.
It was lost pretty quickly. Within 20 years. Maybe that bitter and hasty nation refers to the fact that it's going to, their power is going to pass pretty quickly. That's how I might want to read that.
So verse 14, it says, and makest men as the fishes of the sea, as the creeping things that have no ruler over them. So it was easy for the enemy to come in and just capture all these Israelites and take the all Judahites and take them away because they had no ruler over them. But didn't they have a king over them? But their king, I guess, was useless or...
No, they're saying that it's saying that the creeping things, that they will be like those sea and creeping things that have no ruler over them. They will be like that when the Chaldeans take them into captivity.
Because their king will just break straight away. It'll be so easy for them to just take them away. It'll be as if they have no ruler over them. So they should have had Yahweh as a king, and then they would have been guarded.
Yeah, it was a little late for that. They hadn't had Yahweh as a king since the Judges period. It's been about 300 years. Maybe a little longer. Yahweh said that they would take many captives of Judah here. It's basically a prophecy that they're going to take Judah captive. It's a warning and a prophecy that they're going into captivity. They're being taken away in a net, that they're being dragged off in this net that the Babylonians are going to cast, and they're not going to have any choice about it. They're not going, that last question in verse 17 is hypothetical. Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? In other words, they're not going to stop slaying the nations, and they're not going to stop taking people into captivity.
And they burn incense.
In verse 11, his mind will change and he shall pass over and offend, imputing this his power unto his God. And of course, this is going to be a two-pronged prophecy in Habakkuk. And the first prong is the destruction of Jerusalem. And the second is that Babylon is going to be destroyed in turn. I think verse 11 is the first hint of that.
Yeah, verse 11 is a little bit obscure to me in the KJV, but the NASB has, then they fly along like the wind and passed on, but they will be held guilty. They whose strength is their God. So it's like they're going from place to place and capturing people and passing on. But even though they pass on, God will still hold them guilty.
Yeah, because that they imputed their ability to destroy all these nations to their own God, who was an idol, is what it's saying here. Imputing this his power unto his God, the Septuagint has saying, this strength belongs to my God. So Yahweh is instructing us that the pride of the Chaldeans will be their own downfall in exchange for what they were given to Judah. The Assyrians suffered basically the same fate because they exalted themselves against Israel and were arrogant in doing it, that they were brought down. That's the cause given as the reason for the destruction of Assyria. I actually cite in my old commentary on Habakkuk, I actually cite an inscription, and the inscription is not complete. Some of the lines, beginning lines, are destroyed, but it's an inscription of the book of Nezar saying that from the upper sea to the lower sea, Marduk, my Lord, has entrusted to me. I have made the city of Babylon to the foremost among all the countries and every human habitation. Its name I have elevated to the most worthy praise among the sacred cities. The sanctuaries of my lords, Nebo and Marduk, as a wise ruler always. And then he goes on to boast about taking Lebanon, the luxurious forest of Marduk, and several other places in Palestine, and subjecting them to himself. But it's mostly focused here on Lebanon. The violence of Lebanon. I'm sorry, I'm skipping around in my commentary and I'm trying to figure out where that line came from. That's in chapter 2. So I'm getting ahead of us. The violence of Lebanon is mentioned in chapter 2. And that this inscription seems to explain things that account for why that line appears in Habakkuk concerning the violence of Lebanon. I made the Aratu float down and carry to Marduk, my king, mighty cedars, high and strong, of precious beauty and excellent dark quality, the abundant yield of Lebanon, as if they be reed stalks carried by the river. Within Babylon, I stored mulberry wood. I made the inhabitants of Lebanon live in safety together and let nobody disturb them, in order that nobody might do them any harm. I erected a stela there, showing me as everlasting king of this region, and built. And then there's an ellipsis and it sort of disappears. But he had first organized his army for an expedition to Lebanon and made that company happy by eradicating its enemy everywhere. All its scattered inhabitants I led back to their settlements. And that seems to be people that the Assyrians had moved into Lebanon and not actual Israelites in Lebanon. Because the Assyrians had moved a lot of people into there when they took Israel captive. This Lebanon over which a foreign enemy was ruling and robbing it of his riches. So the Book of Nezahar is actually boasting about creating peace in Lebanon, but the biblical account seems to vary as we get to the end of chapter 2. That's all I have to say for now. I don't know if I should say anything more about chapter 1. One of y'all might have something to say.
I don't know. I guess it was pretty straightforward. Just speaking of them coming and taking away Judah. So maybe I'll just go on to chapter 2 then, Bill.
Fine.
Habakkuk 2:1. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. And Yahweh answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come and will not tarry. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Yea, also, because he transgresseth by wine, he is a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as hell, and is as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all nations, and heapeth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe to him that increaseth that which is not his, how long, and to him that ladeth himself with thick clay? Shall they not rise up suddenly that shall bite thee, and awake that shall vex thee, and thou shalt be for booties unto them? Because thou hast spoiled many nations, all the remnant of the people shall spoil thee. Because of men's blood and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. Woe to him that covereth an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Thou hast consulted shame to thy house by cutting off many people, and hast sinned against thy soul. And so I'm thinking here at verse 9, the evil, that he may be delivered from the power of evil, that's not necessarily evil, that's God's judgment, isn't it, Bill? Oh, no one's here. Well, I finished halfway through, so I'll just wait one sec.
I'm sorry, I thought I was talking, but I was muted. I shouldn't mute myself because I always forget. I always forget I'm muted. That this is the path that the process in the first opening verses of this Habakkuk chapter 2 is described the process of empire building, which was very rapid under Nebuchadnezzar. It took the Assyrians a couple of hundred years to build their empire until it fell, it went into decline after the rule of Ashurbanipal in the middle of the 7th century BC. They had been building that empire for almost 300 years at that time. It took them a hundred years from the time they first went into Syria until the time that they actually began to deport the children of Israel. Where Nebuchadnezzar, he built his empire, he reassembled the Assyrian empire under his own rule, basically, and he did it very quickly. He did it in maybe two or three decades, probably not even that long. It was very quick. It was not quite as quick as Alexander, but it was almost as large an empire. I mean, he didn't make it to Greece, but ruling Tyre, he had points in the Mediterranean that he ruled over also. So this seems to be describing that process of empire building that is going to happen very quickly. And heaping to himself nations and men and riches that it speaks about, describes the process of building an empire, which is what Nebuchadnezzar was overcoming, what was undergoing, I should say. And this is going to turn out to be a prophecy against him for that. It speaks of the pride that he had in doing this and being drunk with wine. Or perhaps that's an idiom for being drunk with success, because he doesn't keep it home and he enlarges his desire as hell and his death. He cannot be satisfied, right? Nobody can die and satisfy death. Death requires more and more people to die. It's an allegory. It's an analogy, and it works, right? Death is always hungry for people to die. If you want to personify death and make an analogy in that manner, it's very fitting that the Nebuchadnezzar can't be satisfied either, because he has to conquer more and more nations and subject more and more people. So he gathers unto himself all nations and heaps unto himself all people, right? So this describes him and his process of empire building, which commences around 605 BC, and that's about when this prophecy had to be written.
In the NASB, it seems to be clearer, because it said, with verse 9, it says, "Woe to him who makes evil profit for his household, to put his nest on high, to be saved from the hand of catastrophe." So he thinks that by having all this wealth and power, he's going to be delivered. but in the end, we know that's not true. And in the KJV, it says that he may be delivered from the power of evil. Well, the evil there must be a judgment from God. So it's evil to man, but it's not necessarily evil.
Right.
To God.
It's always a matter of perspective. It's evil to him. It's speaking about him. So it's what's evil in his eyes.
Yeah, it's like there's two concepts of evil in the Bible. There's like inherent evil, like the genetic evil, the nature of iniquity. You know, the corruption of the fallen angels. That was evil to God. That's true evil. But evil to man is often just the judgment of God, which is actually righteous.
Right. Absolutely.
So he thought he would be delivered from the power of evil. He thought he would escape the justice of God through his wealth and by building it, by setting his nest on high. He thought he could escape the judgment of God.
Yeah, so he's a type for about every Jewish billionaire today.
Yeah. Yeah.
We could convince.
All right, I'll go on. I thought someone else might have something to say. But the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. Woe to him that buildeth a town with blood, and establisheth a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of Yahweh of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? For the earth shall be filled with knowledge of the glory of Yahweh, as the waters cover the sea. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbour drink, that putteth thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Thou art filled with shame for glory, drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of Yahweh's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee, and the spoil of beast, which made them afraid, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and all that dwell therein. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it? The molten image and a teacher of lies, the maker of his work trusteth therein, to make dumb idols? Woe unto him that saith to the wood, Awake, to the dumb stone, Arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. But Yahweh is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. There's some difficult verses there, I think.
I don't know. We've already seen the Chaldeans would heap up treasure and nations and people to themselves. And now it comes to the city. And in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar actually boasts about having built Babylon. It might be 10 or 15 years after this time, 10 or 15 years at least, or even 20, when he made those words to Daniel. I'm not sure if Daniel dates that. He might. He might date it to an even earlier period. Channel. The book of Nezar, I believe, didn't ascend to the throne of Babylon until 606 BC, according to the popular chronologies. But he had actually, for whatever reason, and it wasn't disputed, he had actually built Babylon and took credit for that in his words to Daniel. I don't know if I'm going to find that passage right off. I'm really only trying to date Daniel. In the third year of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, into Jerusalem. And I believe that Nebuchadnezzar, that was probably his first year. Yes, it was, because in Daniel 2 we read, and in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, and I think it's in Daniel 4, perhaps, that Nebuchadnezzar takes credit for building the city. I'd be in Daniel chapter 2. Well, I can't find it right off. I mean, I might try another way. I hate to waste too much time here looking for things, but...
Yeah. Well, you can look for it, and I'll just mention some things, because I think from verse 13, it's speaking of, like, this nation that they're building up. Well, is it not from the Lord of armies that the peoples labor merely for fire and nations become weary for nothing? So they've done all this building up and it's just going to be taken away from Yahweh. So you were speaking about how they're building up this nation and amassing all these people to themselves. Well, that's going to be for nothing. So that's verse 13.
Oh, okay. This is in Daniel chapter 4, verse 30. The king spoke, and that's Nebuchadnezzar, and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? So he's taking credit for building Babylon in Daniel chapter 4, the book of Nezar is. Now, I've read that there were actually bricks found by archaeologists with the name the book of Nezar inscribed on them in what were believed to be the fallen walls of ancient Babylon. I don't doubt that. I don't remember where I read that, though, if the source was authoritative or not. But it's clear that Daniel built that Daniel isn't lying, and Nebuchadnezzar was boasting of having built Babylon. Maybe he refortified it. Maybe he built walls or built parts of the city, because the city already existed. It had already existed and been destroyed a couple of times since the 18th century BC. It was destroyed by the Hittites, who overthrew the empire of the Amorites, that paved the way for the Assyrians to break the yoke of the Mitanni kingdom and come to rule over Mesopotamia in probably around 1500 or 1600 BC. I discussed that in my recent Genesis commentary in detail, but I can't possibly memorize it all, right? So Nebuchadnezzar is boasting about building the city, and Yahweh is stating here, the words of the prophet state here, that the city was built with blood. So at the same time that Babylon's being built by Nebuchadnezzar, he's out conquering all these nations and harnessing their wealth to himself, and that's how he's building Babylon. It's actually built with blood.
But then verse 13, Bill, it's not that these peoples labor merely for fire, all nations become weary for nothing. So that means all this labor they've done is for nothing,
right? Because it's not with the city, and it was only, I mean, eventually it fell to the Persians 75 years later, after Nebuchadnezzar took the throne and began to build it. It fell to the Persians 75 years later.
And then verse 14, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh. Well, I guess these nations have been destroyed for his glory. Would that be how you would read that, Bill?
Well, you know, when Babylon falls to the Persians, and that's prophesied in detail in the prophecy of Isaiah, I think in chapters 44 and 45. So when Babylon falls, then that would glorify Yahweh, who foretold these things.
Yeah, so that follows on from verse 13, where they built up these nations for nothing, and they've done it for nothing because the earth will be filled with the knowledge of Yahweh. And then the last two I don't understand, you know, that are kind of strange, are verse 15 and 16. In the NASB, it has, woe to him who makes his neighbor drink, to you who mix in your venom even to make your neighbors drunk, so as to look at their genitalia. You will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. Drink you yourself and expose your own foreskin. the couple in the Lord's
so,
right
so hand. So it's the look on their nakedness. If you take your neighbor's wife or daughter, you're looking on his nakedness, right? If you're taking something from a man that's his, you're activated. Looking on his nakedness.
So what you're saying is they were getting people drunk and involved in their culture, sort of, so that they could corrupt them and then take advantage of them.
No, I think they were. All right, look at verse 16, and we see the cup of Yahweh's right hand shall be turned unto thee. That's a cup of wrath. So that drunkenness is an analogy for the wrath that the Babylonians had against their neighbors. That they drove their neighbors into destitution, for which drunkenness is an analogy here, and looked on their nakedness, meaning they took their wives, they took their kids, and by raping their wives and their daughters, they saw their neighbor's nakedness. And now the cup of Yahweh's wrath is going to turn onto them for that.
Yeah, it's being used in the same way that it is with Noah and Ham. And it's also in the New Testament, I believe. It's another place.
It's in a Revelation, the cup of the wrath of the wine of wrath of Yahweh. I mean, it's a.
Well, I just mean the nakedness, to look upon someone's nakedness. He's talking about his wife. It's used twice in the Old Testament, I believe. Other than this, two other times.
Yeah, I didn't think it was literally to look at. I thought it was some sort of adultery. I was close. I said, you know, so that they would corrupt these nations, they could take advantage of them and meant sexually. But they were conquering these nations, is what Bill was saying, so that they could rape their daughters and that.
Well, and I mean, that probably was common. That was common to take the women as booty every time a nation was conquered. It was always done in the ancient world.
And they probably thought they were winners, but rather than being winners, they will have disgrace rather than honor for what they did. So, you know, they thought they were winners for conquering a nation and stealing their wives, but they will have disgrace for doing that. And the cup of the Lord's wrath will come to them, I guess. Well, it will. But I mean, Babylon did promote like sin. I mean, when it's gathering all these people to it, and then it's these people are then worshiping a false god, and that in that way it's corrupting them too through their culture.
I think in a lot of ways this is a type for Mystery Babylon, of course, in the Revelation. All the prophecies against Babylon and the prophets are a type for Mystery Babylon, and Babylon made nations that the neighboring nations drunk with its merchandising and its depraved culture in a lot of different ways.
Well, that's what it does today, isn't it? Like everyone's become is instead of having Christian values, some people are taking on like Mystery Babylon type values.
Yeah, it's the pattern of empires.
And then they become whores.
Talk about Revelation. So in these closing verses, they're also chastised for idolatry. The blood they spilled and their idolatry and gold and silver and dumb stones laid over with gold and silver. But Yahweh is in his holy temple, so there we see that the temple's not destroyed yet. So this prophecy has to be in the time range that I had mentioned earlier. From after the death of Josiah to before the destruction of the temple. That's a 20-year period, but I could really here bring it down to just a couple of years to the period after the destruction of Nineveh, which is just a tiny bit earlier, a couple of years earlier, to the rise of Nebuchadnezzar, who it seems to me to be just ascending the throne at this time, but not come into Jerusalem yet, which he had done in like his first year, if not his first and his second. I don't know if it's dated according to the Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Oh, the god Nebu is mentioned here, and that's the first half of the Nebuchadnezzar's name is from that idol of the Babylonians named Nebu.
Well, these last two verses remind me of that that verse. It says, "The gods of the nations are idols, but Yahweh made the heavens." Because it's comparing the idolaters to Yahweh's in his holy temple. And then verse 19's like, "Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a mute stone, arise." So it's comparing idolaters to the true God.
Yes.
That's probably where you got the first part of his name, Nebu, that god.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Oh, okay.
That's what I was saying.
I believe it means sky, right? Something like universe.
And it's the word that we get nebula from, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Nabu, Babylonian deity. Major god in the Assyro-Babylonian pantheon. The patron of the art of writing and god of vegetation, Nabu's symbols were the clay tablet and the stylus, instruments to be held proper to him who inscribed the fates assigned to men by the gods. He's mentioned again in Isaiah 46:1. It's not connecting him directly to the sky, but...
I think it's weird how they had a god for each little different thing.
Yeah. Just like the Roman Catholics have a saint for each little different thing.
That's so true. I did, yeah.
Like the Roman Catholic saint of traveling. Thing is based straight on paganism. It's straight up paganism.
This isn't associating with
Nebu with the sky, though, or Nabu with the sky. Well, this is Britannica. Britannica is really dumbed down online. It really is. It sucks.
Yeah, well, he was obviously at that time, anyway, under Nebuchadnezzar, most likely that god was, like you said, top of the pantheon, him and Marduk. So kind of like a, what was that? There's a word for that, like a senior god or...
Yeah, this says that Nabu had a chapel named Azita in his father's temple, Esagila, where at the New Year feast he was installed alongside Marduk.
User disconnected from your channel.
Babylon, in Babylonia. Nabu was the son of Esagila, which was the temple of Marduk. Something like that. I'm getting out of this. Oh, Nabu was Marduk's son. There you have it. Nabu was the son of Marduk.
Okay.
And Esagila was Marduk's temple in Babylon. So Nabu was installed every New Year's feast alongside his father in the temple. Wow. Okay, I mean, it's all pagan garbage, but subsequent kings made Nabu the son of Marduk. So that's not like primordial. The king said that Nabu was the son of Marduk. So the people had to say yes.
Yeah.
They had no choice.
They did that kind of stuff in Egypt too over time, I think.
Yeah. Well, according to Britannica, the Islamic State of Iraq destroyed all the remnants of Nabu.
Kind of like a pagan civil war, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, Joe, do we have anything else in chapter two?
Anyone? Nope. You want me to read chapter three, Bill?
Why not? Will you finish Habakkuk? Martin will be happy.
Yeah, let's do it. Chapter three. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet unto Shigionoth. O Yahweh, I have heard thy speech and was afraid. O Yahweh, revive thy work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Salah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. And his brightness was as the light. He had horns coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. Before him went the pestilence, and burning coals went forth at his feet. He stood and measured the earth, and beheld, and drove asunder the nations, and the everlasting mountains were scattered. The perpetual hills did bow. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was Yahweh displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made quite naked, according to the oaths of the tribes. Even thy word, Salah, thou didst cleave the earth with rivers. The mountains saw thee, and they trembled. The overflowing of the water passed by. The deep uttered his voice and lifted up his hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation. At the light of thine arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation. Thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. Thou went forth for the salvation of thy people, even for for salvation with thine anointed. Thou woundest the head of the house of the wicked by discovering the foundation unto the neck, Salah. Thou didst strike through with his staves the head of his villages. They came out as a whirlwind to scatter me. Their rejoicing was as to devour the poor secretly. Thou didst walk through the sea with thine horses, through the heap of great waters. When I heard, my belly trembled. My lips quivered out the voice. Rottenness entered into my bones, and I trembled in myself, that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he cometh up unto the people, he will invade them with his troops. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, neither shall fruit be in the vines, the labor of the olive shall fail, and the fields shall yield no meat. The flock shall be cut off from the fold, and there shall be no herd in the stalls. Yet I will rejoice in Yahweh. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Yahweh is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet. And he will make me to walk upon mine high places, to the chief singer on my stringed instruments. So this is a song, Bill, and it's a nice song, isn't it?
Yeah, this is a song, and that word Shigionoth, even though they're not positive about what it means. I mean, there's debate about what it means. It's in a slightly different form in English in Psalm 7. In the title of Psalm 7, the prefix, a shigion of David, which he sang unto Yahweh concerning the words of Cush the Benjaminite, and they think it means a song. So this seems to be like a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet, not upon Shigionoth, because Shigionoth isn't a holiday or anything. It's a song, so it should probably be rendered for a song. In other words, the prayer is being provided to be made into a song. That's my opinion on the word. And I noted it appears in the Hebrew of other psalms, but the King James translation didn't always include the little prefaces to the psalms. They didn't. Or the titles or anything. That they didn't include them. A lot of the information is left out. Maybe it dropped out of the Masoretic text. I don't know. It is in the Septuagint a lot more often. But Shigionoth, I don't think it's transliterated. I think they tried to translate it into something. I don't know. I can't check right now because my pile of Bible books just fell behind a damn shelf when I was trying to put that back. They slid behind the shelf, so I gotta dig them out later.
Yeah, I heard that.
That's what I get for trying to do things in the dark. Only my desk is lit up. Well, anyway, where it says God came from Taman, that just means the south. It's not necessarily the Edomite city. And translations like that in the King James Version really cause a lot of confusion. If you look at the Hebrew, there's no definite article. There's no reason to insist it's the city. It's just the south, generally. God came from the south. Why? Because he's going to Babylon to judge Babylon, is why. So he came from the south, which could be from Jerusalem, from the perspective of Babylon. It's north, northeast of Jerusalem, I believe.
And where it says everlasting mountains were scattered, that means these great nations were scattered and the perpetual hills did bow. So he's coming from Jerusalem to Babylon and he's scattering the nations.
That's east, northeast of Jerusalem, from Jerusalem, the site of ancient Babylon. So it's more east than it is north, but it is north of Jerusalem.
So this chapter is a song, basically, right? Because Selah is the music director.
Selah just means pause. It's a pause, right? It was probably in Hebrew more poetic than it is in English.
Yeah, and then the last line, I mean, kind of indicates it too. Yeah, okay, so. Do you think that he played music, or I guess we have no indication? We're just writing this as like a psalm.
Right. We have no indication. I mean, he may have been a poet. I mean, he was a prophet. So he evidently had the ability to write a song, a metered poem, because it was meter in ancient Hebrew and in Greek, it was meter, not rhyming, that made a poem. It wasn't rhyming. It was meter. Which is a combination of a predetermined combination of long and short syllables with the same feet or meter per line, iambic feet. So you'd have a certain pattern of long and short syllables, and that would facilitate memorization and things like that. But it doesn't rhyme. It didn't. Rhyming is something that's quite modern.
Yeah.
It actually kind of reminds me of in the Roman Catholic Mass when the priest he sings the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah, they do. They do.
And they have probably sounded better in Latin.
They do that. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, and they use like a certain meter to it.
Well, the meter sets the cadence, which creates sort of a tempo. And you could create music for that meter. For any particular meter. And that's how all the Greek poetry worked. Hexameter and pentameter, and they had different line lengths. The tragic plays and a lot of the other plays were all poems originally to be sung in the theater to music.
Now we have that syncopated boogie boo. Where all the meters are all confused.
Well, I don't know that exists because I don't listen to it. So I wouldn't dare listen to any of it. Fuck that.
Yeah, that's where you get jazz.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Because you don't watch television or movies, you're not subjected to it because everything on television has music to it. Whether it's a commercial or a show, all the movies.
Right, but I'm totally oblivious to it.
Yeah, you're lucky because, I mean, the worst part is when I go into like a Walmart and then whatever the crap they're playing, and I'm it's in my head when I'm driving, you know? Every store plays music.
You're tied up with a chord. C-H-O-R-D.
Yeah, and then like you said, Bill, you got to think about the song in order to get it out of your head.
What did you say? You pretend that you're going to the jukebox that's playing the song, and then you start smashing it with the sledgehammer.
Works every time.
No, it's weird. Yes. If you just think of the fact that you're thinking about it, you can get rid of it. You know, it's weird like that. But it works though.
So Yahweh's being envisioned here is going to Babylon from Jerusalem, in my opinion, from the south, and destroying Babylon for the salvation of thy people. And I think that's more of a type for the return of Christ to Mystery Babylon than it is ancient Babylon and the Chaldeans.
They would have been quite noble compared to the Babylon we have today.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure.
Was the Lord displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? What's that, Bill? Because the sea is often the people.
I believe the rivers are races and nations of people.
That's right, I remember that.
That there are allegories for that. They represent that. Quite often in prophecy. I mean, the water rivers that don't really make any sense, right? Why would God be mad at water?
That's probably what Judeo-Christians think.
Yeah.
To devour, verse 14 has, their rejoicing was as to devour the poor secretly. That sounds a lot like Mystery Babylon.
Yes. And here, in after it mentions the rivers, it talks about the oaths of the tribes. So those tribes are those rivers. The rivers are the tribes. Verse 9 defines what's meant by rivers in verse 8, I believe. But the vision disturbed Habakkuk and made him uncomfortable.
Yeah, could the mountains be representative of empires or powers that be?
Bigger nations. Mountains and hills, bigger nations and smaller nations, often in prophecy. I don't know if we have anything more to say about Habakkuk. It's just a two-pronged prophecy. First, the judgment on Jerusalem, and then the judgment on Babylon in turn. And we see that same pattern throughout Isaiah and in other prophets as well.
Well, the only thing I would add, because I'm looking at verse 13, is that the salvation is for the anointed, and then you've got the woundest the head out of the house of the wicked. So that sounds like crushing the serpent's head.
Yes. Yes, it does.
Okay, you want me to cut it?
That salvation with thine anointed would probably better have been translated salvation for thine anointed. Where the New American Standard Bible has salvation of thine anointed, which is fine. There's always multiple ways to translate a preposition into another language. From or of or with or each preposition has several different shades of meaning in different contexts. The King James Version often just seems to pick the wrong one.
Yeah, when I first started studying the languages, I'd always get caught on the prepositions. I'd be like starting, like, why'd they choose that preposition? And then, yeah, I'd always get stuck on them. And then you realize that there's actually shades of meaning, and then you're like, oh, okay, now it makes a lot more sense, because that preposition seems kind of
clumsy.
Yeah, clumsy. And you'd be like, I'd get stuck on it because I was so literal. I'd get stuck on it for age. Like, why'd they choose that? It doesn't make sense. And then I realized, yeah, exactly what you're saying.
Okay, David. It's been good.